All right, welcome to the Saturday morning math group. Oh, sorry.
All right, hello everybody. Thank you for walking out into this winter wasteland to come here. Especially, you're going to let you came from really far away. Today we have Dr. Jennifer Mann, who's going to show us really cool things about DNA. And without further ado, take it away.
Thank you. Okay, so I will turn these lights out on occasion. Some of my slides have a background. I tried to close those, and they don't close any further than that. They're a little, yeah. Okay. Yeah, they're pretty, that's as good as we get, I think, with those. All right, so throughout this talk, we'll pause and do some activities at random times, and if you ever have a question, please ask, okay? We've got plenty of time. That's what we're here for, right? Okay. So first of all, suppose that we had a knot just lying on the floor somewhere, like that one, and you can't see it very well from where you're sitting. Whoops, we need some paper towels here. You can't tell if the rope, which crossings are on top or on bottom from where you're sitting, let's suppose. Let's suppose that's all you can see. Okay, so this is your first question. Some of you did pick up a piece of paper. You might want to scribble that. You may just think through, what's the probability this particular guy is knotted? Think about that for a few moments. Chat with your neighbor. What do you think? What's the probability that this guy is knotted? It seems to have three crossings, but you can't tell which strand is going over or under at each of those crossings. So think about that for a moment. At each crossing, how many combinations or orientations of the strands do we have at each of those three crossings? Who said that? Yes, sir. Two, indeed. Okay. And so there's two at each of the three crossings. So how many total combinations of crossings would there be for this knot? Three crossings, two options at each crossing?
Eight.
Where'd you get that, sir? 2 cubed, okay. You got the three crossings. Two orientations of the strands at each crossing. You might be like this, or draw that better. Or you might be like this, okay. And so you get 2 cubed, or 8. Okay, out of those 8 possible combinations of crossings, how many are knots? Didn't anybody think about that? Yeah, think about that for a few minutes. Chat with your neighbor about that. Out of the 8 possible conformations of crossings, how many would be a knot, and how many would not be a knot? You can play with your string or doodle on your paper or think about it for a moment. How many of those would be a knot? Shut one of these doors. Yes, math group. Saturday morning math group. Welcome. How many of the 8 would form a knot? You might figure that out yet? Pardon? One does for sure. There's more than one. Did you come up with one? Do you want to sketch it on the board for us? No. Would anyone like to sketch what they're thinking on the board? Show everybody else. Okay, look at that chart, those of you that you have. Is it this somewhere on there? Yeah, which one? The second one, she's saying. Okay, yeah. The second one on the knot table that you have, that one that has a little 3-1 by it, that's one possible conformation that would be a knot. Okay? Can you think of describing the other possibility, even, if not coming up and drawing? Who could describe it? How would it differ from the one you see on your paper? Okay. What about if we, on your image, on your knot table, the crossings that are going over, what if you switch those to under? What if you switched every crossing there? You would have the mirror image of the knot you see. Would that be a different knot? Well, that's a question. But it would be a knot. And so 2 out of these 8 could be a knot, okay? That this thing is knotted. It's 2 out of 8. Okay. All right, so those are some questions that we might think about as a knot theorist. Okay, so first we just jumped into that question, but now we're going to talk about what do we mean by a knot, and then we'll move on to what's DNA, and what do we mean by a DNA knot, and what are all the different topological forms of DNA that happen in cells, and how are they dealt with? What happens when they're not dealt with properly? Those are the things we'll be talking about today. Okay? Okay, so first of all, if we want to know what a knot is, we need to know when something's not a knot as well. So looking at this image and maybe taking your string that you have and trying to form it on your little desktop, if this was formed in one of your strings and you tape the ends of your string together, let's say, could you unravel this to just basically be a circle without having to cut it anywhere? Pardon me, sir?
So I think the answer is yes, because
yes, sir?
If you tie a loop and then you put the right string through it, it'll particularly just squeeze the knot until it becomes a perfect circle.
Okay. So you are allowed to squeeze and stretch and shrink and twist and bend this guy and push strands over other strands or under. You're just not allowed to cut it anywhere, okay? So if you did squeeze and stretch, shrink, bend, twist, untwist things, what do you think? Let's take a vote. Knot or not a knot? Knot?
Not a knot.
Not a knot. Let's see. Oh, indeed. This thing can be unraveled. Okay, so notice that this section here goes over and then over. So like he was saying, we could squeeze this all back over to here. Then we could push it under this string because it's passing under and under. And we get a big loop over here, and we could untwist it from there. Okay, so, Aaron, while you're there, will you switch the lights back on? Let's sketch that process, maybe a few of the steps. You're free to sketch on your paper or just watch what we're going to do here. Okay, so let's try to start with this guy. Okay, did I get it? Notice what I'm doing that was not on that first side is I'm making sure we can tell which strand's going over and under at each of the crossings by drawing a break in the strand that I mean in the 3D world passes under that strand. That's the convention for how we draw these knots in the plane of our paper. They're 3D objects. We're trying to draw them in a 2D place. So we try to show some of that information about what was going on up in the 3D world. And by convention, that's how we draw that. Okay, so a whiteboard or a chalkboard is a good way to mess around with these knots. Ropes, of course, are as well. But here, we can make a little change, see where it was, go back if we need to. So what I'm going to do is this piece here that passes over, I'm going to squeeze it and shrink it like the young gentleman was mentioning we could do. Because it's passing over, I could shrink it all the way into just being a loop like that. And do I like it? I didn't cut anything. I just pushed over. Yeah, that's good. So now I will go ahead and erase this. And I can draw that one back in solid then. It wasn't really broken. It was just behind that other piece, and now I've pushed that other piece over here. Okay? So that would be step one. And then again, you see that this is passing under. So I could keep pushing it that way, behind this strand that's passing over. Okay. And really, I've just got something like this then. And that's just a little trivial twist there, right? I don't have to cut it to remove that twist. I just untwist it. Okay, so indeed, I could just untwist that little thing. And then I've got something. Whoops, I didn't untwist it correctly. I've got something that is indeed a circle, basically, right? If you have studied geometry, that you're saying, that's not a circle, is it? No, because you have a very precise geometric definition of a circle. Yes, sir? Pardon me? Looks like a?
It looks like your lung.
Your lung, dogs. It did indeed in the end. Yes, okay. But as we're saying, in this world of topology, we're allowed to stretch, shrink, twist, bend things, and push things around. We're just not allowed to cut them or put them back together in a different way or add a piece hanging on the side. So, yeah, if we can smooth it out to look like a circle, in the world of topology, we'll say that is a circle. So this guy is called the unknot, the trivial knot, indeed. Okay. Then, here's another one. Oh my goodness, look at this one.
Where are the materials?
Okay, look at this one and see, do you think it's a knot or not a knot? You take your sheet of paper. You get some string here.
Probably not.
And there's a little rope to mess with. And Aaron's helping you with the rest. Okay.
This one is a knot.
Still people playing with it. Great discussion. Anyone need string? Any pair of people not have a string or rope? Because we have plenty. I think it looks like everyone's got one. Okay. Okay, let's take a vote again. Let's see. Is this guy a knot? How many say yes, it's knotted? We can resolve this without cutting it or something. How many people say not a knot? Okay, not a knot is a little higher percentage, and indeed you're correct. This one's harder to see. Okay, but might start somewhere. Let's start on the right again, because again we see this guy's going under. So we could push this in, and then there's just a little twist. We could untwist that, and then there's several other steps, and we could draw it out, but I did this in farce. Okay, see if that convinces you. Okay, let's see. What did I do from here to here? It looks like... I push this one through, this little loop here, and undid the twist as well. Okay? So I'll give you a second maybe just to look over those and try to digest that. It's a little harder to see, but you can just push, twist, untwist. And this guy is also basically, well, is indeed the unknot. Okay. So some things are going to be deceiving. Yeah, we're going to have to investigate them further to decide, do we have a knot or not? Okay, and we haven't even said yet what we mean by a mathematical knot. So here's a bunch of images of ropes or strings or something in different conformations. Which of these do you think we would call a mathematical knot? How about, let's start down here, how about this one? No, we just looked at that one, right? That's the one on that previous slide, that monster guy. No, he unraveled, so that's not a knot. What about that middle one on the bottom row? Yes. Is it on your chart somewhere? Yes. It's upside down on the chart, okay. What's it called there? 4-1, okay. Yeah, that one is a knot. What about this guy? No, that was that first slide, right? Okay, so that unknots. What about this one? No. What about this one? Yes. Okay. That's on your chart as well. We looked at that a moment ago. Okay. A little bit of a change. What about this one? Nope. Okay. Yeah, we changed one of the crossings from that second drawing to this third one. What about this guy? Why not?
Not connected.
Okay. Yes, sir? Yes, sir? Okay, if you can force that string to become aligned with your hands, he's saying it's not a knot. Okay, that's a pretty good understanding. So a mathematical knot, we are indeed going to say it has to be some closed curve in three space. It's somehow embedded such that we can't unravel. Like we could unravel these guys by just pushing and shoving this guy around with our hands without taking the scissors, right? But we can't unravel that one as hard as we try if it's in a rope or string where we have indeed tied the ends together in some manner, fused them together, let's say, okay? Then that, not right there, yes. We could play with it and move it around a lot. We've got a lot of flexibility with what we do with it, but we're not going to remove that knot from this rope unless we come along and cut it and do some strand passage, right? Okay, so yeah, that one's a knot, and it's a trefoil knot, and this is called the figure eight knot. So those two are the knots, formal mathematical knots on this page. As time allows, we'll mention this guy again near the end. Okay, now we need to warm up a little bit. Okay, so you can form groups of 5 to 8 people, however time will allow, or room will allow. So we can get one group kind of back over there easily. One group can step right out the door if you like, a couple of groups, and we can get a group there. We can get at least 3 groups, I think, on the stage, perhaps. And so stand in your group, and just everybody put their hands in, and just grab hands with somebody else, and then see what you are. What shape are you? It doesn't really matter. It'll get more interesting, the more people you have. We definitely have room on the stage. You can open the door and step out if you need to.
Would you be okay with people sort of working on the stage during
right.
a couple of people?
You know, during
activity? Yes, yes, yes.
Like,
yes.
Yeah, it's hard in this room to get.
Okay.
Does it matter how we hold
you? It doesn't necessarily, so just do whatever you want. Just reach in and grab somebody. Let me join you.
Come on.
Let me join you. Okay. Okay, just have one. Oh, wait, somebody's got to come in here. Okay, now, can we unravel ourselves?
Probably.
No! Without letting go. Okay, and you can untwist. Okay, so we are indeed the unknot. What do you know? Okay, try it again. Let's just see what happens. Now let's try not to join hands with the person next to you on purpose.
Okay.
Let's try to avoid the person next to you and see what happens. Okay. We'd be next to each other. Okay. Okay, there we go. Now let's just see. How did that change? Can we do something now?
As I aim for a trefoil.
We can rotate. We'll let ourselves rotate. Okay. Why don't the two? You think
you step over her in the purple jacket?
You. I can't step over my own arm.
Oh, you. Well, there we go. Okay. Now, do you come in for a moment?
I'm still blocked by this string.
Yes, we are still blocked.
I'm stuck.
You can try it. Just step over. The girl in the purple jacket over my arm?
Yes.
Okay. Can you step over my arm?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try to do whatever. Okay. And then I'll go over there.
Okay.
Double
crab? Oh. Okay. That's a little better. Woo! Woo! Wait, let's go. Let's go back down.
Evan,
does she?
Yeah, Evan.
I think we are going to be knotted, is what we're finding out. Why don't we try to figure out which knot we are? Okay. Okay. So come back.
This is not going to work.
Oh, okay.
I think it didn't get.
I don't think this is going to work.
It's a good try, but we were tied up for sure. Okay, we were definitely not them. It was a little too hard to see were we a trefoil or not, but we were definitely not at that time. We were still one piece, so we were not a link, but we were definitely not the second time. Okay, all right. Yes. Okay, let's see.
Okay, why can't we do this?
You guys are the unknot?
We can't make a knot.
You probably need some more people. Another thing is throw your hands in and purposely don't get hands with the person next to you. Sometimes that'll tend to get you to submit this.
We understood the process.
Are you knotted or not?
Yeah. I think
which knot are you? Oh, Aaron's helping you. Okay, yeah. Okay. Are you guys knotted or not?
No.
You are knotted. Can you tell which knot you are then?
Oh,
yeah.
nicely to have coaches on the exterior. They have a greater view of the overall situation. Okay. Oh, you can do a little twist here.
I know we can.
And you're allowed to, like, just flex that point. Yeah, we'll say you can do that. You didn't. Okay. Then you're probably truly not. Can you tell which nut you are? You're pretty twisted right here. Okay.
Stepping over
didn't help. Yeah. Okay. Are you? But you are one knot, right? You're not two links. Let's check that out. So your hand, and then where's your other hand go to him, and then you go to, and she goes there, and then you go. Yeah. Okay. You are one knot. Okay. All right. Good. They're not. They can't.
They're not.
Yeah. And they can't. They almost should have been in the out there. You gonna sketch them? Okay, good. Okay. Okay. Have an observer sketch. Okay. All right.
They are a strange knot. I've said that lots of often.
I'm curious to know what that happens and whether it's invisible. So, do you think you can? You may have been, so that's a question, right? You may have discovered a new knot. On the other hand, how big is this knot?
Did you get a chart? There's still some charts out here. Take one, and we've just done a few things, but you can, that might work okay. You can also, let's go ahead and cut you one of these. That was kind of, those strings were just what was left over a bit, but, and sometimes they work well, but on some knots, kind of it gets a little sticky to itself, and not as, so you could take both if you wanted to try them. Okay. You're welcome. Are you guys trying another one? Because you're welcome to still use this space. Okay. Okay. Okay there. Can you just sketch the line from, like, put a point in each person if you want, and just sketch lines from arms,
so they said, I think that there are,
so to speak. Once they get their sketch, then maybe we'll come back together. They can look at it over time and decide which one it might be. Did somebody sketch or not? Did someone try to? Oh, okay. Oops.
They don't seem super close to finishing the sketch, so yeah. if you want to cut it off,
okay.
That's fine.
Okay. Okay, let's come back together. Thank you, but okay. Let's come back together and try something else. Okay, that's our little bell. Okay, so some of you will start out with a group of, say, 5 people, and a lot of those groups were just the unknot. You were able to unknot yourselves. How many people were in your group back there in the end? 8. They had a group of 8 people, and they were definitely knotted. And they were trying to sketch it and figure out what knot it might be. So that's something to talk about. How many people are going to make a knot standing together? How many people would you... I think that's my next slide. How many people would you need if you wanted to make a trefoil knot? 3 would be enough. Okay, indeed. Oh... if you didn't have a rope or a stick or something to connect your 2 hands, most of us aren't that flexible. But a single person could do it if you were holding on to the ends of your rope. That's an activity to try later. How could you make a trefoil knot with just your 2 hands and a single rope? Okay. Not making the knot in the rope before you pick it up, that is. But some other things to consider. Sometimes you just put your hands in, and a lot of you were holding hands with the person next to you. Well, that was probably not going to be a knot, right? You could have put the restriction on the group that when you put your hands in, you purposely join hands with anyone other than the people standing next to you, right? That would be more likely to knot. There are a lot of variations on that. Okay. So something that we start doing when we're looking at knots is just making observations about them. What kind of things can we count about these curves? And one thing we could count is how many crossings do we see in these particular diagrams of each of the knots? Okay? So for the unknot or the trivial knot, how many crossings? Zero. Zero is an important number at times. We need to know that guy has zero crossings, indeed. Okay, so we need to know where we're starting. How many crossings are on this guy? Three? Four. It's called the figure eight because it kind of has this figure eight shape in the center, but there are four crossings, okay? How about the square knot? Six and the granny?
No, the square knot has six.
Six. And the granny has six as well. Any Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts in here? Okay. Yeah, yeah. So you remember how to tie. Some of us may know how to tie the square knot versus the granny knot, right? So you go, if you're holding your string, you can go right over left and through the loop, left over right and through the loop, and then put your ends together and you've got the nice square knot, right? What you just did when you did right over left and through the loop and then left over right and through the loop, you formed a right-handed trefoil followed by a left-handed trefoil. So the one on your sheet and its mirror image, and you made the square knot. Okay, but if you tie either two right-handed trefoils or two left-handed trefoils, you get the granny knot. And as a Boy Scout or Girl Scout, you might know this one's not as strong if you're trying to tie two pieces of string together or something. This one is stronger when you use the right-handed trefoil and its mirror image, the left-handed trefoil. You get a stronger knot. Okay, but those are some asides. So crossing numbers, indeed, are one thing we could count about particular diagrams of a knot, but they could change. For example, that trefoil, I don't have to see it with just three crossings. I could see it with more than three crossings. Let's go back and look at that. There's the trefoil as it is right now. And here's the three crossings that really make it a knot. This crossing is just a trivial little twist crossing. We could undo it. But here is a way to draw the trefoil knot with four crossings total. So when we say crossing number, we mean the minimal number of crossings that you could draw it with. Okay, and each of these were minimal crossing number diagrams. Okay, suppose you had two pictures of knots, and just looking at them, you notice right away that they have different number of crossings. Do you know for sure that they're different knots? No. Why not? Everybody's pointing over there. Yeah, they could have been like that. Some trivial crossings, like those little twist ones I just put in there. So that's not necessarily a way to tell that you've got different knots. Okay, and we just saw a picture of the trefoil with four. In the previous slide, the trefoil we know can be drawn with three crossings. Another thing that we can count about a knot is called the unknotting number. Now, this is a bit more challenging than just the crossing number. We can't just look at it in a meet and just start counting something. We have to play with these guys to determine their unknotting number a bit. Okay, unknotting number means how many crossing changes would you have to make. So somewhere where the crossing information looks like this, we get to go in and change it to looking like this. So we switch which strand is over versus under. That's a crossing change, okay? So for example, in this drawing, if I was going to do a crossing change here, I would come here and I'd race that guy and push it behind the other one and make this one be the over strand. That's a crossing change. Let's play with that trefoil. If I did that crossing change, now is this a knot? No, let's play with it. Okay, this little twist, we knew we could untwist that guy. So let's start by untwisting that one. And then, look at this piece. Now it lies over. So we could shrink it in without having to cut anymore. And it just looks like that then. And then that's just a twist. And we could straighten it, not to a line, but to what? A circle. Yeah, at that point, it does straighten out. Oops, sorry. To a circle. So, with the trefoil knot, if we change one crossing, we can convert it to the end knot. So the unknotting number for the trefoil is 1. What about the figure 8 knot? Play with that a moment and figure out what is its unknotting number. 1. You just need to change the top one, he says. Okay, let's just sketch that. Okay, so what do we have here? Okay, is that what we have originally for that figure 8 knot over there? Okay, so someone suggests let's change this top one. Okay, so this piece that's going over, let's push it behind the other one and now make it be behind, and this piece is the over strand. Okay, and then let's see. All right, well then this piece is going under, so I could erase that and just push it back over here, couldn't I? Okay. I do it slowly on purpose so you can hopefully see what I'm doing. And then, well, let's see. This piece here, I could push and untwist. That's just a little trivial twist there, isn't it? Okay, so I can pick that up, and if you want, and think about lifting that piece over there like that. Okay. And then I could shrink it. It doesn't have to be that big. I was just showing you where we came from. And then that's just a little twist. We can untwist. Okay, so he just changed the top crossing, and the figure 8 knot becomes the unknot. So the unknotting number for the figure 8 knot is also 1. Okay, let's not sketch that square knot, but what do you guess? How many crossings do you think we'd have to change that square knot to the unknot? 2. What was it made up of? 2 trefoils, remember? And the trefoil had unknotting number 1. You string 2 together in this particular manner, it still has unknotting number 1 plus 1 or 2. Okay, so that's one to play with and think about. So these concepts come back and we start talking about the DNA knots. Right now we're just going to try to get an understanding of what these terms mean in context of mathematical knots. Yes, sir? That's a good question. Does it matter? What do you think? How about for the trefoil? Do you think it matters which of the 3 we change?
No.
Not at all. How about the figure 8?
Never.
Okay. How about for some other knots? Is it on your chart? You think it's possible that it matters which crossing you pick?
Yeah, I think two.
It does. So you want to know the minimal number of crossing changes. Just like crossing number was minimal, this is also the minimal number of crossing changes. So there may be other ways to convert it to the knot in 2 or more steps, for a given knot, let's say 3 or more steps. But indeed, for those two, it doesn't. This guy, you've got lots of choices again. Yes, sir?
Is it possible for a certain diagram of a knot to have a higher unknotting?
Yes, sir. Yes, that's a good question. Is it possible for a certain diagram of a knot to have a higher unknotting number than another diagram? Yes. Yes. Now, we're just looking at very simple knots, and I gave you their minimal crossing diagrams, so it was quite easy to see what these unknotting numbers were. But in general, that's going to make this a tough problem, isn't it? If you look at that chart, these guys could have lots of different diagrams. These are very pretty ones drawn here. But yeah, this is not an easy problem in general to answer. Other questions, comments? Okay. So I was going to try one more. I think we will. Okay. We're just going to get up every now and then. So this one, you're going to try. Now, before we said don't let go of hands, right? Let's have one demo group come up front and try this one maybe. Or 2. Let's put 2. Let's get a competition going. Okay. So let's see. First 5 people over here and another 5 people come up over here. Let's do it like that. 2 live demos going. Competition. 1, 2, 3 on this side. 1, 2, 3 on this side. We need 2 more in each group. 2 more volunteers each side of the room. Anybody? Here they come. 1 more person is needed. 1 more volunteer. Come on down. Okay, thank you. All right.
We only have 4.
He's coming to help you, and you guys got 5. Okay, you're good. Okay. So, now, you're going to try to form the knot you see these people in the slide making.
It looks like a star.
It does look like a star. So form that star knot with your friends there. And you guys form the star knot. Okay, we're going to split right down the room. So you get to go with that side. You go with that side. Purple and black shirts, you go this side, okay? This side, try to tell them what you want them to do to unknot. You guys, you can give them advice. You got the knot?
I think we're done.
You have the knot. Don't let go. Great to go. Do you have the knot?
Yes. Yeah.
You have the knot. Try to unravel yourselves without letting go.
This is impossible.
You can't. Okay, still don't let go. We're going to make a crossing change in a moment. Can you unknot? No. Okay, so both groups agree. We cannot unknot these. Now we're going to do a crossing change. How many crossings does this...
Right group, help is coming.
Okay. What's the crossing number right now of these two knots?
Five.
Okay. So we didn't look at this one yet. That previous slide, we talked about a knotting number, the truffle, the figure eight, and the square knot. So here we've got a five crossing star knot. We want to know what is its unknotting number. So now look carefully at this next image, and this is where the coaches are going to be helpful. You want to make... let's see. Two crossing changes. So the points of the star, remember, is where a person is standing, and these are arms. So help them make these two crossing changes, coaches. So.
How about, yeah, put your hand out here.
There we go.
Okay, you made one.
There you go.
Two.
And then, okay, now see if it unknots.
There you go. Whoa.
Keep going, keep going. Oh, wait, you made too many. No, no, you got it. Yeah, just switch. Ah! Okay. All right. You did it too. Thank you. Okay, very good. Very good. Okay, you can have a seat then. Again. Thank you, thank you. Way to go, way to go. It was nearly a tie. Okay, have a seat again. That's a cool one, isn't it?
What type of knot is that?
What type is that? I think it was the square knot I just tied a moment ago, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah, there's two truffles. One truffle, two. You want to take it? You play with that one for a little while. Okay. So, indeed, this five-noted knot, we were able to change two crossings and unknot it. And for this particular five-noted knot, indeed, its unknotted number is two. It does look a lot like a star. Oh, you can take it to your seat. One, two? No? Okay, thank you. this five-noted knot that indeed looked like a star, here's the knot again, is called a torus knot. We'll talk perhaps a bit more about this before. Torus. Have you ever heard the word torus before in this group? What's a torus? What's it look like?
A torus is a donut.
Yes, ma'am. It's like the surface of a donut. Okay, so this is called a torus or donut knot because you could imagine that, it's perhaps hard to see, but that the torus or the donut could pass through between all these arms. And so this knot could lie on the surface of a donut just by winding it around the in and out of the hole of the donut, right? Okay. We talked about this one already. Three people could make a truffle knot. You've got this image I printed out. So this is from some software called KnotPlot, developed originally by Rob Shirina as he was working on his PhD. Now he has this company. I got his image years ago, and that was the link where I got it out. That may not be the current link for it, though. But indeed, these are computer-generated, very nice, minimal crossing diagrams of knots. Now, mine, the top, a lot of these are gold. My printer's not doing so great, so I printed in grayscale for you. But a lot of these are gold, and then we get into some multicolored ones. So these are knots. What are these guys? Links, some of you may know. So they have two components. They're two circles. Oh, thank you. Two or more circles somehow entangled with each other, okay? So there are mathematical knots, which what we've been looking at so far. There are also things called links, which are two or more circles somehow entangled within their cells. So you can't undo the tanglement unless you cut one or something. That would be a mathematical link. Okay, so now let's move on and talk a little bit about DNA. Let's just briefly get an idea of what the structure of DNA is, and then we'll talk about what we mean by DNA knots. Is that a question? Okay. So you don't have to grasp all this, but some of you will. How many of you have already studied DNA structure in high school? Yeah, okay. Some of you already have a general idea. And I'm just giving you that some of the information, we don't have to know it all today. But the basic central dogma of molecular biology is that you have DNA, RNA, and protein in cells. who knows which happens first or comes first, but indeed the DNA replicates, and from the DNA you can transcribe and make RNA, and from the RNA you can translate it into proteins, okay? DNA encodes for everything that our bodies need. We have to transcript it into RNA before we can get out the proteins, which are enzymes that they catalyze every reaction in our body, okay? So it's essential to life, obviously. And what's it look like on a molecular scale? Here we go. Here's what one strand of DNA looks like. You've got a phosphate group hanging off the side that's negatively charged. You've got a sugar, and you've got one of the nucleotides. You've either got guanine, cytosine, adenine, or thymine. Notice those have a little bit different structure. And this one strand of DNA is linked through the sugar phosphate. So that forms like a backbone of sugar phosphate groups, okay? But as we mentioned, keep that in mind, every phosphate group gives this molecule a negative charge. So overall, if this is a molecule of DNA, it's highly negatively charged, okay? Now you have two complementary strands that base pair together. Do you know, remember what G binds with? Yes, ma'am? C. And how many hydrogen bonds did they form? Do you remember that? Three. Not necessarily important. And A and T then must bind together. They form two hydrogen bonds. So you've got a complementary strand to this that binds on the other side, and that's what we see here. And as they bind, every about 10.5 base pairs, you get a full turn of that helix. Okay? About every 10.5 base pairs, we'll get a full turn of this helix. So just stacking up base pairs, we get, let's say the white is one complementary strand and purple is its complement. And they get twisted about each other about every 10.5 base pairs, okay? So we've got that level of interesting twisting going on alone just when we start stringing together base pairs. But then, say in a human cell, we've got 46 chromosomes of DNA packed in the nucleus of the cell, okay? And there's a great deal of different levels of packaging that goes on. We're not going to talk necessarily in detail about those, but I want us to appreciate this packing problem. So if the human cell was enlarged, say, to the size of a basketball, the amount of DNA in those 46 chromosomes that has to be packed in the nucleus would span 150 miles. So think about it, a basketball in relation to 150 miles. You've got to pack that much DNA. It's very, very thin, of course. You've got to pack all that into the nucleus. So packing the DNA alone can lead to a lot of topological geometry problems and questions. Okay, so just want you to grasp that and appreciate that. And indeed, I like this statement, came from Neil Ostroff at Vanderbilt back when, well, shortly after grad school for me, that the topology affects virtually every nucleic acid process that requires the double helix to be opened and moved within the cell. So topology, which is this branch of math that's sort of like abstract geometry, just a very loose definition. This topology, which knot theory is a branch of, this is a biochemist from Vanderbilt, not a mathematician, saying topology affects every nucleic acid process that requires the DNA to be opened and moved. And so there's a lot of those and such processes, and we'll briefly mention those today. Okay, so another question what we want to talk about, I guess I need to skip back to this slide for a moment. We look at this one strand of DNA. Based on the sugar phosphate group arrangement, it has an orientation. It has what we call a 5' and a 3' end. When its complementary strand comes along on this side to bond to it, it must line up in its 3' to 5' end, okay? So there's a certain arrangement that has to be maintained. The strips of paper you have are rectangles, basically. They're very little bands. Lights, please. And this will be my band for right now. Okay, so it's a very simplified model of the DNA, this ribbon band. We're going to imagine that one edge of our ribbon is one strand of DNA, and then the opposite edge is its complementary strand, okay, for a moment. So one strand, maybe this strand that I'm, this edge I'm holding towards you right now, is running, say, 5' on my left to 3' on my right. And then the other edge, the edge that's pointing towards me right now, has to then run 3' to 5', okay? So Have you formed Mobius bands in this group before? You have. How did you form a Mobius band? What did you have to do to your rectangle to make a Mobius band? Yes, ma'am?
Take a paper and twist it half.
Yes, that's what you do. You take a rectangle. How many sides does your rectangle have? May I hold up one of yours? It's a little bigger than mine.
Four.
Well, it has four edges, yes. How many 2D sides or faces did it have? Two distinct ones. When you did a half twist and joined your edges together and created your Mobius band, do you remember what was special about it? How many edges and sides did it have? How many edges did it have then? One. And it only had one face because that half twist made the front and the back side join together once you taped them. So if you weren't here earlier last year when they did the Mobius band activities, you can do a half twist tape together, and you can trace around and find that you will trace the whole thing. So you must connect the front and the back somehow when you do the half twist and glue, and indeed that's what you do. Okay, so my question to you is, could DNA ever form a Mobius band? Would that make sense? If this is a 5 prime to 3 prime in, and this is a 3 prime to 5 prime in, could it be a half twist and still be a DNA molecule? Would a DNA molecule ever have just a single half twist in it? Okay, say that a little louder for everybody.
The 3 prime end would be joined with another 3 prime.
You'd be forcing or trying to force a 3 prime end to be joined to another 3 prime end. Yeah, from the orientation of the two strands, that's physically not going to happen, okay? Unless there's a lot of crazy stuff. Okay, so yeah, that doesn't happen. So how many twists would we have to put in our band to make something that represents a twisted DNA molecule? An even number. Not just two, but any even number. We could do two or any even number, and it would be a realistic twisted DNA model. Very simple model of DNA, but it would be realistic. Okay, so that's something to think about. Okay, so then with your neighbor, indeed try to put, let's say, two half twists. In other words, one full 360 twist, tape. When you do tape, get your neighbor to help you. Hold your two ends nicely like that, and then be sure you have a piece of tape that goes all the way around the seam, because we're about to do a cutting process on it. So don't do a little overlapping seam. Try to be as neat as possible, and then be sure your tape goes all the way around so your partner can help you. But the first trick is try to get two half twists in there. That takes some work. Okay, where's the guy? Here it is. You got some guns
over there in case okay. That will be useful for now.
Yeah, I did something.
Can't find the end of that tape. You got to tape them together, which taping is a challenge here. Aaron, I can't find the end of this tape. I think other people are having trouble too. Do you have the end of your tape roll? It's hard to find it. Some other people are having trouble getting it. Oh, that one will work. Okay.
If you want, just the one.
Sure. Okay.
Who else needs it?
Okay. Yeah. Did you get the end of your tape yet? Because we can cut some off of here.
Just
maybe cut about right there, and that'll be.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, miss.
And did she want one too? Yeah, cut her one too. Okay. There we go. Okay. All right. Anybody need some tape? Because it's hard to find the end of those rolls, isn't it?
We already have.
Do you want? Are you? Is it coming? Or you want to borrow some of this? Let's cut off a piece of this. There you go. Anybody else need some tape? Oh, let me don't take your scissors. Anyone need a piece of tape? Okay, so... Once you feel like you have the two half twists, then in, you need some tape. Oh, let's see. Let's, let me give you a piece of this wide tape. I can make sure that it, like where it was sticking up a little, like at that edge, make sure it just goes down really nice and firm. I believe so. Make sure it's two twists. We'll know when you cut it, if you had the two or the no. Okay. So to make sure, if you're still making, trying to do your twisting, I hold it thumb and forefinger and hold my thumbs up, then I turn my thumb down and down again, and then I make sure I bring it straight up and together so a neighbor can help you. But then be sure you tape all the way around your seam. If you do two half twists, it has two sides. That is a good question to talk about. Okay, once you have the two half twists in there, how many sides does this guy have? Can I hold yours up? Yours is a nice big one. How many sides does this guy with two half twists have? I mean, you two. Okay. And how many edges then does it have? Two. It still has a two edges. If you had put an odd number of half twists in it, you would have had one side, one edge. But every time you put an even number of twists, you're back to two sides, two edges. So the two twists, that is like a DNA molecule. It could be. Now, I want you to imagine that you are replicating this DNA molecule. So you're going to unzip the two complementary strands. You're going to come in with your scissors and cut. So, you know, pinch it at one little spot and cut in the middle and unzip it. And see what you get. That's where you need to be sure you taped your seam all the way around nice and good. Okay. When you get the end molecule, now draw on it or run your finger around it. Decide how many edges and sides you have. And can you tell how many twists you have? Well, no, not there. Like, sorry. Like, pinch it, and you're going to cut, like, down the middle of the band. So, start it like that, and then put your scissors in there and go just down the middle, okay? Okay, did you see what I mean? So somewhere, just pinch it just a little and make your cut right there, and then just go right down the middle. Yeah, like she's doing, okay? So be sure that this tape is really good around that seam. And then when you get to that, just still tape right down the middle of the seam. I mean, cut down. Excellent. Okay, so some of you are still doing that. Let's look at this little ribbon. I know it's small, but it's watch what happens. Okay, so I cut on my seam, and then I'm going, I would use scissors, or look how this guy just comes undone by itself. Right down the middle. I keep pulling. Let's hope this works. Keep pulling. You would just keep cutting all the way around. And then I get a little snag. Okay. I do need scissors for my last little cut. It got off the line. Okay. And then hold yours up, if you will, as well. What are you left with? How many pieces now?
Two.
You had two pieces linked together. Okay, so if you start with a twisted DNA molecule and you replicate by just going down the middle and breaking apart the two strands and making a copy as you go and just breaking them apart, what are you going to end up with? Two linked, okay? Now, you think that DNA is just twisted twice? No. To pack that DNA in the cell, if it's, we're mainly talking about plasmid DNA right now, but anyhow, all DNA is super cool. Look at this. We call this a level of coiling because, as we mentioned, every 10.5 base pairs about, you get one full turn of the helix. So just organizing the DNA at this first level, we get some coiling. But then,
the DNA is indeed twisted. If I start twisting this molecule, notice what happens to itself. Back in my grandparents' day, the telephone cords were okay, it coils about itself at another level. So that's all we mean when you say DNA is super coiled. It was first twisted from just every 10.5 base pairs you got to twist. But then there is some twist in the overall molecule of the DNA that makes it that level coil about itself one more time. Now, so this is far more than two twists that I just put in this guy. So if we were to break apart purple right here, it would be linked together more than just a simple little link like you're holding up there. But indeed, you should have seen, you got two molecules, they're linked together. How many half twists do each of those molecules have? What would you say? Two. So you still have the two. They are realistic DNA molecules. They have the two half twists. Okay, so that means they have how many edges, how many sides each? Two. Okay. All right. So you can try variations on that or keep playing with that as you want. But let's move on a bit. Okay. So the question then arises, if DNA doesn't form Möbius bands, we'd eliminate that as a possibility, not realistic for DNA. What does it form? Well, apparently at times it can form links, we just found. And we were just mentioning prior to those links, it is supercoiled in some level. Indeed. Okay. So here are the three interesting topological variations on DNA. It is supercoiled. Thank you. And the supercoiling is desirable to the cells. It allows them to take some big old long molecule and compact it and pack it into the cells. That the supercoiling at a certain level is desirable. But then it does present this problem when you replicate the DNA, right? It is desirable to coil it up and pack it in the cells, but then you've got these links at the end of replication that might have to be dealt with. And biologists call these links catenanes, from the Latin word for chain. But also, there are a lot of processes in the cell. Okay, I take this supercoiled DNA molecule and I pack it in there. All right? And there are a lot of processes in the cell that temporarily, picoseconds, break the DNA and put it back together. What if, as this is packed in there, I put it back together and I end up with something that is indeed knotted with itself? Okay? That can happen, too. So you can have just supercoiled DNA, which is just twisted. You can have, indeed, knots in DNA, and you can have two or maybe more different DNA molecules linked together and form links or catenanes of DNA. So these three images are electron micrographs of DNA that is actually in each of these conformations. And here's some more images of different levels of supercoiling. So this guy is hanging out. We can see he is an open circle. Then there's a little bit more supercoiling or twisting added. And as you get more and more supercoiling, this circle looks more and more like a little rod, doesn't it? Okay. And then here are varieties of knots. So this is one of the trefoils. I think the right-hand left, and this is the left-handed trefoil down here. So this is the actual microscopic image, and then here someone's traced out the knot, the mathematical knot nicely for us to see what it is. This one was a seven-noded knot. It turns out to be a seven-noded twist knot. This one is a seven-noded knot. It's a seven-noded star knot, basically. Torus knot. Here's another very nice one. From a paper by DeWitt Summers, who is my PhD advisor. Here are a lot more. These are out of the Casarelli lab, which is no more, but from my days of grad school. So here's a trefoil, a five-noted knot, the twist knot, a six-noted knot, seven-noted knot. There's one of those six-noted knots that's a granny there, and a couple of different torus knots, both five-noted torus knots. If you're trained to look at these images, you can tell which strand is going over, which piece of DNA is passing over, and which piece is passing under. So you can classify these knots from these electron microscopic images. It takes a great deal of talent and skill to get these images, though. So by a DNA knot, we simply mean a single DNA molecule. Let's make it a little simpler. That is somehow entangled with itself, such that if we did all the twisting, bending, stretching we want to, we're not going to get that knot out of there. we would have to come in and cut the strand somewhere and pass a piece through, and then we could get the knot out. So a self-entanglement of a single DNA molecule is a knot. But then, would you hold up your blue again? At the end of replication, you sometimes have two strands that are linked together, maybe once or maybe more than once. And that's what we mean by DNA cattening, two or more strands that are entrapped together, such that you, again, we could, if these were sealed up or attached to protein somewhere, we couldn't remove this guy without, again, coming in and breaking somewhere and passing some strand through. Okay, so here's some more catenanes. This one is probably the, after the two-component unknot at the bottom, the 2-2-1, this is the hop link, and that's the one you saw when you unzipped your double-twisted band there. This is what you should have got. It's also called the hop link. And that's another knot in the middle, the figure eight knot. And then this is the white head link, also somewhere in those chart at the bottom where it starts getting two-colored. Here's some more, which with many more crossings. So it can get, we just ourselves created the one with the two half twists that was just linked with two crossings, but there could be two strands of DNA that are linked with many more than two crossings. All right. So how does this sort of stuff happen? It happens, as we mentioned, just trying to compact the DNA within tight spaces. It also happens due to these enzymes that we all need. There are enzymes that get their name from this branch of math called topology. They're called the topoisomerases. Topo, topology, isomer, they have two DNA molecules with the same DNA sequence, might have different topology. Anything that ends in an ace is usually an enzyme. So these topoisomerases, there are a couple types, but they can come in and bind to DNA. There's a type 2 that can bind. Pardon me? You got a knot this time? No, you have a link still. Okay. These topoisomerases can come and bind to double-stranded DNA and make a break in the DNA. The enzyme, imagine, is my hands. The enzyme remains bound to the broken ends of the DNA while it allows another segment of the DNA to pass through this opening, just temporarily passes through that opening, and then the enzyme reseals the DNA and releases it and unknots it, and that happens in the order of picoseconds. These enzymes are found in every cell of every organism that we have studied. So they are essential to life because they come in and they take care of these knots and catenanes and they maintain the proper level of supercoiling for us. Okay. But in their own reaction, there are times when they might themselves make a knot, and replication can lead to knots and or catenanes. Supercoiling, as you start coiling up a big long DNA molecule, notice strands start to collide. That can sometimes lead to knotting. But basically, just as Ostroff said in that quote earlier, any reaction on the DNA that involves a transient break could lead to a knot or a catenane. Okay, so yeah, we're going to maybe come back to that. Is it time to take our break? Okay, let's pause there and then we'll come back to look at it, DNA knots some more.
So we're going to take a 10-minute break to, you know, go get snacks, use the bathroom, whatever. Feel free to talk to, you know, well, to talk to each other during the break, but also to talk to Dr. Mann and talk to me.
And play with this activity up here?
Play with the ropes.
As you want.
Fun, thanks. I will see you back here in 10 minutes.
How many twists did you put in before you cut? Back to how do these knots arise? So we'll look at a couple of occasions what might cause knots in DNA. They can arise during replication. In the original Nature paper by Watson and Crick in 53, when they published their model of DNA, they made this statement that since the two chains in our model are intertwined, it will be essential for them to untwist if they are to separate, which is what we encountered when we took our rectangle and put two half-twists in it and joined it together. We had two half-twists. If you tried to replicate it, as we were doing by cutting down the middle of it, we ended up with links. Right? So they were pointing out that if the two chains are intertwined, they're going to have to untwist to separate. But they made the statement, although it is difficult at the moment to see how these processes occur without everything getting tangled, tangled meaning knotted or linked, we do not feel that this objection will be insuperable. So indeed, they thought, okay, there's some. They recognize there's something about their structure that will lead to links at replication, but there must be something in cells they're hinting at that takes care of this. So replication, we won't go into details again, but basically you have those two complementary strands and they have to breathe apart for a moment, like when you first put your scissors to your band and made the first cut. You made a little bubble in your band, right? That's basically what happens to the DNA. It breathes apart, and then you come along and you make a complementary strand to bind to each of those pieces. So this is in a molecule somewhere that was supercoiled. Putting my twist back in there. Okay, so somewhere we came along this twisted molecule and we breathed apart blue and white. Those are my two strands, so to speak, and started replicating them. But look at the way I'm holding this particular one. Here's my replication bubble. I've got coils ahead and behind my replication bubble, right? Okay, so topos hang out behind and ahead of the replication forks, and they handle removing supercoils so that replication can proceed and introducing supercoils back into the newly replicated strands. Okay, because when you want that, once they split, you want this guy to be supercoiled, you want that guy to be supercoiled, but supercoils up here or here are going to get in the way of replication proceeding both directions, right? So supercoils in the original strand temporarily need to be removed so that this replication can move along, so you can unzip without getting links like you did. So topos are expressed and active at the times of replication in every cell for us. Okay, so there's a lot more detail about how that happens, but basically that's what I want you to appreciate. And so if we stall replication partially, as has been done in these pictures, you can capture images where the DNA is at times knotted, okay, in these partially replicated DNA molecules. But there are things that might stall replication in cells that aren't healthy, let's say. Or drugs might at times stall replication and lead to these knots. Zooming in on one of those, this top right one in the first slide, we have, as we trace out what we have basically inside the replication bubble, so here's the strands that's not replicated yet, the two ends, but this part in here has been replicated, and in that bubble, basically, we have the figure eight knot. So the ends here do not look joined, and they're not. But indeed, we've got something within the bubble that's essentially a knot, right? And topos would have to take care of it there. But they do if you've got healthy cells and fully functioning topos. Okay, and so here's just another image of how you start breathing apart the two strands of replicating. You can get a knot temporarily in the middle of replication. Okay, they also can arise during DNA recombination. And let's look at a very brief introduction to that. So recombinases are, again, ACE. It's an enzyme. It recombines the DNA in a different manner. They are essential at times to various organisms, but they are proteins basically that come along and they cut the DNA segments. So like the topos, these recombination enzymes can cut the DNA briefly, and then they usually cut in two different places at the same time. So let's say we've got this black area and white area, this is a strand of DNA, here's another strand that's kind of near it. Like this. We're going to cut right down the middle of both of them, and then we're going to rejoin them. We're going to join this piece now to the piece that continues this direction. And we're going to join this piece to the piece that then would continue upwards, like that. So it's a physical rearrangement of the DNA sequence. That's what these recombinases do. Okay, but in so doing, if there was some supercoiling going on over here in the molecule, these recombinases will form knots and then occasionally links, depending on the orientation of the strands when they break and rejoin. Okay, so DNA recombination can lead to knots and or links. Again, we're not necessarily going into the details of these, but here's a molecule. Basically, what are these crossings. They're from supercoils. And then these two loops at the end are brought near each other. And if we come in and break both of those strands there and then recombine, so now this piece of DNA is recombined with this one that continues this way. And the piece that was coming up from this direction gets recombined with the and continues this way now. That rearrangement of the strands takes this supercoil unknot and forms the knot you guys formed a moment ago with yourselves, that five-noted torus knot. Okay? And then with this certain arrangement of original strands, this recombination event forms what? What is this guy? What is it? A link. Okay, so there are times it can form a link. All right, and so, again, I'm not going to, there's a lot in recombination. We could talk, do a whole section, whole talk on that. But briefly, these are the knots that, in my work, I had a means of making these particular knots in double-stranded DNA molecules. We had these two different recombination systems that we manipulated to let us accumulate a whole bunch of knots of a particular knot type. So if you look at your knot table, find these. We've got the 3-1, that left-handed trefoil, and the 5-2, which is called the five-noted twist knot. This is not in your table, this granny knot. It's two left-handed trefoils. This one is in your table, the 7-2 twist knot. And these two aren't in your table. These are composite knots. This is where you got a trefoil tied in series with a five-noted twist knot. And then one of you on the break tied this in your rope. Who was that? Yeah, okay. So, indeed, this is three trefoils in series in a particular rope. But that can happen in DNA. He brought it up here just, I'm not sure. What motivated you to form that on the break? I'm just. Okay. And added another knot. Okay. And indeed, that's one that we can make in double-stranded DNA. Not in great quantities that when you get out to these nine crossing numbers knots, but indeed we can make those particular ones. And then we have a different recombination system that allows us to generate these particular knots. So this is the mirror image of that trefoil, the right-handed trefoil. This is either the five-noted torus knot you made physically earlier or its mirror image. I'm not sure which one we made earlier. And this is the seven-noted torus knot. And then these guys, I've drawn with two colors, they are what? Links, okay? So in this system, we also are able to get some of the links, that four-noted link and six- and eight-noted links. Okay, that's another topic at the bottom. We can make very small supercoiled molecules, and that can be of interest to particular studies. But generating knots with a particular knot type in large enough quantities to then see what do topoisomerases do on those particular knot types. That was a big part of my doctoral research and trying to bump up these systems to get enough knots to look at. And then know what I had going into the experiment. Know but mathematically what knot I had. Then let the topoisomerases work on these knots and see what the outcome was. Okay. I investigated what were the consequences of the DNA knotting, and you were asking, so a lot of you were asking me that on the breaks. So, if you have a knot in a DNA molecule, the first thing that can happen is if you're trying to move on that DNA molecule and make some RNA to then make proteins, well, that knot can just be a physical block to the protein machinery that has to bind and move along the DNA. Now, this is not the only proteins complex that bound to that DNA molecule. There's a lot of other reactions going on in other places on the molecule. DNA never hangs out in a nice, happy, static state. It's always being manipulated by proteins and pushed around in the cell. Okay? So, if you do have a knot, it is quite possible that it would be pulled tight. And then, if you ever get a knot in your fishing line or whatever, and you pull it tight, what happens? It breaks. So it could break the DNA molecule. And breaks in DNA are very bad. But it also could just prevent the proteins from moving along and transcribing that piece of DNA in that knotted region. So if you had a gene along the DNA strand in that region that was essential to live in your particular environment, let's say you're a bacteria and you're being exposed to ampicillin. If you've got an ampicillin-resistant gene, but it was only encoded right there, you're out of luck, right? You're going to die. Okay. But we can put knots in DNA where we know their sequence, and we can observe what happens when we do let the knots accumulate. We block the topos from acting on the DNA. We see what goes wrong, and we see that replication and transcription both have problems when the DNA is knotted. And as I mentioned, if there's an essential gene, it can kill the cells. But additionally, when you do break the DNA, the cell has lots of mechanisms to try to deal with broken DNA. It grabs those broken ends right away and sees, is there anything in the area that it fits with? Can we fit it back together? If so, it might be our own DNA, and we better repair that break. If not, it's invading DNA, because when viruses first inject their DNA, it comes into your cell linear. And so if your cell has mechanisms to recognize linear DNA and break it up and degrade it immediately. What if it was its own DNA, though? What if you had a cell and you were taking antibiotics because you had a bacteria, let's see. Okay, and you come in, that drug gets into that bacterial cell, and it's a drug that targets the topoisomerases. The topo is that enzyme that hangs out, breaking DNA, passing through, putting DNA back together, really on picoseconds time scale, right? What if the drug binds in between the protein DNA complex and prevents the protein topo from putting the DNA back together? Then you can take that normal action of topo, which was helpful to us, it broke and put back together our DNA, and you can cause the topos to make breaks in your DNA. And if it stays broken, indeed, your cell will try to put it back together. If it's able to, then that might cause rearrangements of your DNA. And we saw that happening a lot, too, in the cells where we induced knotting, made the knots accumulate. We added drugs that made the topos not function properly. We found that the DNA itself got rearranged in a lot of different ways, not just one way, but the cell was trying anything it could to deal with that broken DNA. Sometimes it just killed off the cells. Sometimes it rearranged the DNA, fixing those breaks and putting it back together in new ways. Sometimes those rearrangements were helpful in the cells we were looking at. Sometimes it took that ampicillin-resistant gene, put it in a place in the DNA where more of that ampicillin resistance was created for the cells, greater resistance, and the cells were able to live longer and live in outrageously high concentrations of the antibiotic. So maybe DNA knots are driving evolution. Who knows? Another sad fact about these topoisomerases being the targets of many anti-cancer drugs is that often when a child is treated for a childhood cancer, later in life they develop a secondary cancer. And it might be associated with the chemotherapy they received as a child that targeted their topoisomerases and caused DNA rearrangement somewhere else in the body. And so perhaps these topological changes that arise because the topos were blocked at some point cause DNA rearrangements. Sometimes helpful, sometimes unhelpful in cells. Okay, so we talked about these topos indeed, though, are there. If we're healthy and our enzymes are fully functioning, they take care of these things. They keep the proper level of superfluon we want in our cells, and they immediately resolve catenanes and knots that arise in our cells, whether they arise from replication, recombination, or any other means. If we're healthy and our topos are fully functioning, this is happening all the time in the order of picoseconds. And so when we replicate, well, things are separating, sister chromatins are separating correctly and everything, thanks to our topoisomerases. And as I mentioned, they are necessary for life, and they have been found in every cell of every organism ever studied. They, basically, you can think of, they control the proper DNA topology in our cells. And what I want you to definitely take home is how they do that, is they are able to bind to double-stranded DNA, break the DNA, and pass a piece through and put it back together. So they might form supercoils when they do that. Or, if you're not, your DNA was not at first of all, when they break and allow a piece to pass through that break and put it back together, they might resolve knots, or they might resolve catenanes, because of this action that they can do. However, because of that action where they transiently break the DNA, we can target them. If it's a bacterial cell or cancer cell, we could target those topoisomerases in those cells and cause breaks that would kill off those particular cells. So this is still an active area of research. How do the topos directly manipulate their DNA strands? There are some structures of topoisomerases in the protein database that you can find, and, but still getting more accurate structures is an area of research, and seeing how they directly interact with their DNA strands. We have a lot of means of measuring that, but still there are many open questions in that area. Geometry and topology, I think, definitely plays a role, though, in how the protein DNA topoisomerase acts on its substrate. Okay, oops, I went too far there. And that's about it, though, I think. I was going to briefly, instead of page down, I'm sorry, I hit the end button. I was going to briefly tell you that there are also knots in RNA and proteins. Let's start there. Here is a partial topoisomerase structure and how it might interact with this DNA. DNA has been superimposed with it. So here's the enzyme, notice. And it, we do know that whenever we capture images, there are some electron micrograph images here of these little black blobs are the topo and the stringy bit is the DNA. We do know that whenever the topo binds to the DNA, we find it bound at a bend in the DNA. The question is, did the topo bind the DNA or was the DNA already bent? The DNA might have already been bent because if you have a knot in DNA, well, it certainly bends the DNA a lot, being knotted, right? Okay. And the topos are trying to find the knots and the catenanes and get them out of the cells in picocircuits. So the geometry and the topology of the DNA might have already had the DNA bent, and that might be what's attracting the topo to act here instead of over here where there's no need to act. And, of course, if you've got catenanes, would you hold yours up again and try to pull the two pieces apart just gently? If you're at the end of replication and you've made these two strands and you're trying to pull them apart, well, what are you going to do to the DNA if it's linked? You're going to make bends in the DNA. Are you going to break it? Okay. All right, your right hand lives, your left hand dies. The broken DNA. Okay. As you pull it apart, if it's linked, you're going to make bends in the DNA, aren't you? Okay. So that might be what's attracting the topo to act there and resolve those catenanes. Or it could be a combination of that and the topo bending the DNA as it binds. But there's still a lot of open questions there. You might know that a lot of enzymes in our cells when they... Oops, the rope hit it. You might know that a lot of enzymes in the cells, when they bind to DNA, they bind to particular DNA sequences. The topos don't bind to particular sequences. We want that to be the case because we want them to act wherever there's a knot or catenane. We don't want them to only act in certain areas, right? So indeed, they don't have preferred sequences. And they can act where and as needed. Okay. And in doing so, they resolve these things that would otherwise be detrimental problems for the most part for us. And so they may be thought of as the notenlosserin of our cells, in particular of the cell of every organism that's ever been studied. So we can end the formal part there and take questions otherwise at this point.
So we still have a bunch of time left. If you have questions for Dr. Mann, there are, you know, like she said, tons of open questions in this area. You can definitely come talk. We also have all these supplies. We have another helper who made it to the second half, so you can come to her for help with any questions. And some stuff you can do, well, you know, in the end here, in the last part of this presentation, we heard a lot about the knotting and unknotting processes that go on in living cells with DNA. And if you want, you can take your strips of paper and your strands and try to do those to get a feel for how they work. So, you know, you can take a piece of string and super twist it and then cut it in half and see what kind of knots you can get. You can try to, you know, play topoisomerase and undo the knots.
Your strip of paper.
But, yeah, there are plenty of things you can do. I'm sure Dr. Mann has a ton of activities you could try with these. And, yeah. Oh.
Questions? Yes, ma'am?
Does the University of Texas offer some kind of pre-plan that allows people to study biology and mathematics and with one another?
As an undergrad, perhaps Dr. Sadoun could help us more with that. There's a biomedical engineering program. There are biology departments and labs just across Speedway from us here who do this sort of research. And there are mathematicians in our department who have collaborated with people here and all over the world on these type of questions. So it is possible. You could either be a math major, or you could be a biology major, or a biomedical engineer, and you could direct your program to study some of these type of questions, certainly more so at the graduate level. But
there's also the Paul Mann Scholars Program, which is basically designed to help people come up with interdisciplinary degree plans. I mean, you still have a major, but basically you wind up having a minor that you sort of create yourself under the guidance of some faculty advisors. And you could craft a minor that really puts you into these mathematical biology issues. Whether you're a math major and you do some bio stuff there, or you're a biology major and you do some math stuff there, you know, you can make it work.
Yes, ma'am? Yes, ma'am. And that's very helpful for thinking about some of these knots. Blackboards are. So, yeah, you may indeed. Anywhere around the room. And you can take your chart and draw one and then see how many crossings you'd have to change to unknot it. Other questions, comments?
Are there knots in DNA that can benefit us?
Not to our knowledge at this time. And so over the break, some people were asking about knots in proteins, and I threw some other stuff in here we didn't talk about. But indeed, knots can exist in proteins. But proteins, well, when they come off, when they're first made, you've got a string of amino acids, right? Sometimes the backbone itself is not. Sometimes side chains form pseudo-knots. But indeed, there are some proteins where the backbone itself is knotted. Technically speaking, the ends are free, but proteins don't hang out like that, right? As soon as they're transcribed, they collapse into some preferred structure that's compact. The knots are usually embedded deep within that structure, and they're believed to be beneficial to proteins. They stabilize the protein in its desired conformation. Not very many complicated knots have been found, up to 6 crossings, but there are now families of proteins that have particular knots. Those are various structures. There's even this database now of knots, of proteins that have knots in their structure. You can even submit a protein sequence, and they'll tell you whether or not it's knotted or such. So, knots also exist in RNA temporarily at times. But basically, all DNA knots are bad. Except for, if we go back to my one statement, let me revise that. Generally speaking, they're bad. But notice I said these were the results of experiments I did, that they're bad for replication transcription, and that they cause mutations, basically. Now, most of the time those mutations are bad, but there are times, more often for bacteria and viruses than for us, when those mutations are good, okay? And they can, for bacteria and viruses, we have evidence of times when those rearrangements allow them to live longer in the presence of antibiotic, or they share antibiotic resistance. Lots of things can happen. But so there are, it depends on your context and your perspective, I guess, is what I'm going to say. Because in my particular experiment, let's say I had E. coli that was harboring a plasmid, then I knotted the plasmid. The plasmid encoded for ampicillin resistance. When I grew these E. coli in the presence of ampicillin, and the topoisomerases were fully functioning and resolving knots, these E. coli could live. When I block their topoisomerases from acting so that the knots accumulated in those E. coli, most of them were dying off. If I have any of those pictures in here or not. Most of them were dying off, but there were some that were not dying off. May not have put those in here. And the ones that were not dying off, we could grow up more of those and see what their mutations were. And odd things had happened. They had taken that ampicillin-resistant gene, basically, and put it in a place where more of the beta-lactamase, the protein that was made off of that gene that allowed the E. coli to live in that
episode, more of that was made. And they could live in outrageously high concentrations. So if you were that bacteria, that was good for you. You were up in your ampicillin resistant by a lot. But if you were the person that might be infected by that bacteria, that's bad for you. So that's what I'm saying. It depends on your perspective. Yes? Quite possibly. Viruses can evolve in a lot of different means, and do indeed evolve by a lot of different means. Recombination is certainly one of them. Yes?
Are there times when replication is not wanted, and if there are, could the introduction of knots be useful to that?
Yes, so like if it's a cancer cell or a bacterial cell, we don't want it to replicate. And indeed, we do. That is what many of the... I have a 14-month-old daughter, and last week, she goes to daycare, and last week she contracted conjunctivitis, and so did I. And I was prescribed ciprofloxacin, which is a fluoroquinolone, which is a drug that particularly targets the topoisomerases. So whatever bacteria was in my eye, its topoisomerases were being blocked by those eye drops I was putting in. And indeed, its DNA was getting knotted or catenated or broken, and it killed off the bacteria in my eye. So, yes, and there are times when you want to block replication. And for us, that would primarily be in cancer cells and bacterial cells, and gosh, only if we could target viruses. But we can target bacteria and cancers with many drugs nowadays. And most, a lot of those, I should just say a lot of those, do indeed target the topoisomerases. And if they prevent the topos from converting supercoils properly, unknotting and uncatenating, then they do indeed block replication in those cells and transcription. Other questions, comments? Okay, thank you. So you can just come up and ask questions or play with the knots and strings around the room. Here's some books I also brought if anyone wanted to know what else they might read. If you're interested in just knot theory, then the Colin Adams knot book is a nice accessible one. If you're interested in more of the topology biochemistry, but from a math perspective perhaps, this one's nice. Pure Biology, Jim Wong, the superhero of topoisomerases.
So you see,
we have 9 minutes. Yeah, I didn't do bad. Okay. Yes. Good. Good.
So,
what is your background? I'm just always curious.
I'm a computer scientist.
Okay. Okay.
Actually, I was wondering. So, how did the topos know to unknot? Do they ever end up knotting by mistake?
Rarely in healthy cells, but indeed, yeah, that's still a question. How do they know? And so those last slides where I was showing the topo bound to the DNA and such, I might even undo this because I like the, if this wakes back up here. It, yeah, we can see things better here. Where the topos are bound to the DNA. Oh, there were those mutation slides. The static images we've captured so far of topo and DNA bound, the DNA is bent. And so there's still lots of theories about, is the bend in the DNA because the DNA was knotted and catenated, or did the protein add the bend? But I really think that the geometry and topology of the DNA did cause some particular, like if you look, something I didn't really point out, links, often the type you get, you're going to have almost 90 degree angles where they're meeting. Okay, so there is going to be a very particular geometry of where you want the topo to act if it's a link. Another type of knot that I was make that we have a lot in cells are what are called twist knots, because the DNA is supercoil. And then the most common type of knot you get is this type of knot, where it's just been a supercoil molecule with one little mistake like that made a knot, okay? This is called a twist knot because you've got this region that's just twisted, which really were just supercoils before they become a knot, right? And there's really only this one region up here that's like a clasp on a necklace that really makes it a knot, Okay. And you really, again, that looks a lot like the link in the catenanes. Okay. So there is a particular geometry in the type of knots and the links that happen a lot in cells. And so I really think it's the topology of this knot type that causes this geometry, and that's probably the conformation the topo is binding to. But there are still a lot of unknown questions about that. That's the current theory, that it's probably, well, I would say it is. Yeah. But still, there's a lot of questions about that. People have investigated from a lot of different angles.
Okay. Yeah. Also, more maybe. So, in my head, my picture of a chromosome was just a double strand that wasn't a closed loop.
Right. But it's so long. Yeah. So, and I didn't really mention that. But indeed, all the knots that I was able to generate and study were in closed plasma DNA. But the same problem, and then this, in that first early slide, I said that's not formally a mathematical knot. But if this is our DNA, yeah. If we look at the packing of those DNA, even chromosomal DNA, I had one slide of that early on.
I see. So just because it's so long, you can...
Yeah. These ends, it's really long, and then it's all wrapped up in all these different ways. Even though it's technically free, there's so much compaction of the DNA within that chromosome that there's no way that you're going to slide a knot all the way to the end. It exists like in the replication bubble. You can kind of just capture it in a sphere, which is the way a lot of people study it as an animation. They generate this and then close it off to like a sphere around there and just look at it locally. The topo really is going to have to act there. It's not going to be able to physically push it off the end because this is bound to other proteins and all packed up in so many ways. So even though technically for mathematicians to assign coordinates and curve to these and study them and integrate and differentiate along them, we need a closed curve. But in reality in the cells, that's still going to be a knot because it has to be acted on right there to resolve it.
Yeah. Which department are you in?
I'm in our math department, yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Emma, nice to meet you. Okay, what grade are you in now?
Seventh.
That's a good time to get interested in science and math. Yeah. I took a lot of science and math all along the way as well. Not sure. I definitely wanted to be a math major, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with it. And this was, I have one sister who's a chemistry major, and one's a biology major, and I'm the middle child. So I was kind of the blend. Indeed. So, and then in the end, the chemistry major became a doctor, and my younger sister, the biology major, became a scientist at St. Jude Children's Hospital in Memphis, doing in a lab that works on topoisomerases. It's just by complete coincidence. So good. Glad you could come. Okay. Hi.
Thank you for sacrificing your time.
Oh, good. Thank you. I appreciate that. What grade are you in now?
I'm a senior.
Senior. Wow. Where are you headed? You know that yet?
I am applying here at U of H.
Okay.
Torn between biology and
right. I was a graduate student officially through Florida State, but I ended up doing 5 years of research in a lab at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And this is both places are great, but I'm just going to say, if you know a lot about UT, probably about U of H, if you're there, what was very interesting is right there in the Med Center, there are a lot of institutions that collaborate and have joint degree programs, even at the graduate level at least. So U of H and Rice and Baylor and UTMD and everything, they were a lot of joint seminars, but even joint degree plans where people were collaborating, physicists, mathematicians, computer scientists and such. So in the lab I was in Baylor, we were quite an interdisciplinary lab, and we had a computer scientist guy that came along just behind me. We, of course, had biologists and molecular biologists and biochemist people, but the computer science guy that came along behind me, he got his degree and then was officially from U of H, but he was half in our lab and half at U of H working with a computer scientist. And he's the one in our lab who got the structure of the topoisomerase. And he did a 3D model. I don't know if I have that picture in here. No. But he did a 3D model of the
3D printer thing? You know how you can, I don't know all this, but okay, he printed with a 3D printer a model of his crystal structure of the topoisomerase. And then we kind of played around with it with my rope and his model. How could they be bound together? But it, his structure was still had a lot of arrows in it. It was the best one at that time, though. But it was still something to start with and see how could things be configured together. So that's what's interesting about places like that. You can really get in there and collaborate with different people. Let's see, where would I maybe have that picture? Let's go all the way back to Bela. It was the last thing I did. Let's pick out. Who knows what this is? Let's see what this one is. Oh, that's one. That's just a little data. Oh, well. I'm trying to think where I quickly have that picture.
Thinking about this, thinking about the technique you used to prove that it doesn't matter where you have things on.
Sorry, I don't have it right away. But anyhow, it's interesting if you know, because this area, it naturally brings together people from different disciplines. And once people from different disciplines start talking, I think it helps solve the problems because everybody's got their own perspective and their own piece of the puzzle. So I strongly encourage collaboration. Okay, thanks for coming today. Okay.
You can look in another direction.
I want to show you something interesting.
Okay.
I found an alternate genetic code.
In what? Wait.
I'll just show you the base as well. So one of them we share, it's adenine. So we know this. But there's a few other ones that are also oligomers of hydrogen cyanide. Like this. Anyway, I found four different ones. Adenine's A, and then I had the others. I just named them B, D, and E, because C is already taken.
Okay.
And I found the base pairing rules for them, number of hydrogen bonds.
Okay.
And I'll just make a table here. A, B, D, E. So it's kind of strange. Okay, so for A and A is for...
they don't bond. Okay, yeah, obviously.
It's two there.
Okay.
It's three here. It's two here. Two... B is interesting because it doesn't show any preference. It only has two bonds to each other one. And then D is weird because there's four here.
Wow.
And three. Like it's self-bonded three. With four hydrogen bonds.
Okay.
And then two here.
Huh. So as far as the hydrogen bonds and all the topology, if you have a bunch of... ATs with the two hydrogen bonds, it'll be a very flexible DNA sequence. It can bend very sharply, obviously, if you've got a run where you've got a bunch of ATs because you only have two hydrogen bonds. But then if like you've got a run of GCs, it's not as flexible because there's three hydrogen bonds between them. So this guy would be very strong compared to what we're used to. But this would give another molecule that would give a very flexible DNA strand.
Sorry. I think this is E. This is D, this is A, and then B is... This is... Okay. So these are all oligomers of hydrogen cyanide. And this is a really common molecule of Titan. Like, we see it condensing year by year. And it condenses into these bases, and these bases can form this genetic code that's very different than the one we're used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if life can form there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't use amino acids. It uses something a little bit different. Like, okay, instead of glycine, they have... They have this. Like... They use amino alcohols instead of amino acids, and it's really simple to convert between them. All you need to do is add formic acid, and water, and this part goes with this.
And this is glycine, the simplest amino alcohol, amino acid, sorry. So, that's just an example.
Mm-hmm.
But I found a bunch of different ones that you can use. These amino alcohols aren't stable.
And what is your
oxygen,
major?
Though.
Are you undergrad, grad? Or not? No, not yet.
I'll be going in next year.
Oh, okay. And what do you think you're major in, or do you know yet? You don't know yet?
Right now, math, but I'll probably do chemistry.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to find out what are all the conformations of DNA that you could make with those new nucleotides. Both just...
I'm not sure if it works as well as a genetic
code. Yeah.
Because with D bonding to itself so strongly... Yeah. Never mind.